Welcome, everyone, to the 8th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, Alexandra Katahakis will be teaching on sex addiction as an affect dysregulation, a neurobiologically informed holistic treatment. She's broadcasting live from Chicago, while the Sounds True team and I are here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours, and if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now, it's my honor to introduce you to Alexandra Katahakis. Alexandra Katahakis, MFT, is a certified sex addiction therapist. She's founder and clinical director of the Center for Healthy Sex in Los Angeles. She's a senior fellow at The Meadows, and she serves as faculty for the International Institute of Trauma and Addiction Professionals. She has extensive experience in working with a full spectrum of sexuality, from sexual addiction to sex therapy, and problems of sexual desire and sexual dysfunction for couples and individuals. She's the author of Sex Addiction as Affect Dysregulation and Erotic Intelligence. Alex was also a contributing author to the award-winning book, Making Advances, a comprehensive guide for treating female sex and love addicts. She's been a recipient of numerous awards for her work, including the Carnes Award, the Book Award from AASECT, and the Clark Vincent Award. Welcome, Alexandra.
Thank you, Christy, and thank you for having me. I'm excited to be a part of the Neuroscience Summit this year and to talk to all of you about my holistic model for treating sex addiction, which emerged as a result of my studies with Dr. Alan Shore for the past almost 10 years now. In addition to being a sex addiction therapist, I'm also a clinical sexologist certified as a sex therapist. So I have merged my studies and my thinking over many decades together to come to this idea of looking at problematic sexual behavior and how we can move towards sexual, erotic, optimal sexuality over time. So I want to give you some context by starting to say that I think we're undergoing a major sexual revolution at this time with significant changes to who we are sexually, how we have sex, the meaning we make of sex. More people are seeking alternative marriages, they're divorcing, they're questioning who they are sexually. We're more open to sexual fluidity. So it's a fascinating time and revolution because our values and mores as a culture are really changing. Old constructs are falling away, and the concept of normal or normative sexuality is really up for interpretation. And I think you'll find as we go along here that the concept of sex addiction is greatly misunderstood, and you'll see that assumptions about its existence as a sex negative model or imposing a morality or normative sexuality have been weapons used against really the absolute pain and despair that I think people struggle with who are faced with this problem. And as I go along, I want to make a distinction here also about the difference between what I call classic sex addiction and contemporary sex addiction. They may seem similar in presentation because they both appear with relational impairment, compulsive sexual behaviors, and often comorbid mood disorders. But the difference are the underlying catalysts. So for example, classic sex addiction or classic sex addicts, people that self-identify as such, always, or very often, almost always, have a profound history of childhood abuse, whether it's emotional, physical, sexual, or pathologically neglected from infancy on. So these are traumatic structures that are underlying these compulsive behaviors over time. And then contemporary sex addiction is more what we think about when we think about pornography addiction today, because there's a rapid onset. There's a very early first exposure to pornography And the symptoms of the contemporary sex addict are a result of the pornography, whereas those who were abused in childhood have symptoms as a result of longstanding affect dysregulation. And then just also to contextualize the word marriage, if I use that word marriage, I'm talking about anybody, same sex, in a monogamous committed relationship. So with that, we'll go on to the next slide then, and I'll give you some history about addiction. So as early as 1929, the first English use of the word addiction came into play by someone named Firth in his writing called Antithesis. And this was a Latin word that means assigned by decree or made over, bound, or devoted. And we can certainly say that addicts are devoted to whatever their addiction might be. And then by 1906, the American Medical Association journal said, it means little whether one speaks of the opium habit, the opium disease, or the opium addiction, because people were struggling with opiate addiction and all they cared about was getting health, but the medical community was arguing about it. And they finally began to recognize physical dependence on alcohol and drugs as marked by tolerance and withdrawal and the near impossibility of what was being called dope sick addicts overcoming their habits. And they saw this as a mental illness rather than a moral weakness. And that was a substantial shift for the medical community because it was a time that drug addicts were arrested as criminals. They weren't seen as being ill. And by 1935, Alcoholics Anonymous was on the scene and 12-step group model was formed at that time. And by 1950s, Gamblers Anonymous was soon followed by Overeaters Anonymous, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous, Sexaholics Anonymous, and similar worldwide fellowships formed by the 1970s. And then in the 1960s, addiction treatment was being approached as principles using the principles of behavioral psychology. So the whole notion was just stop your behavior and then you'll be fine. And then by the 1970s, addiction treatment adopted a more cognitive psychology approach. So then there was this synthesis of stop your behavior and stop your stinking thinking. So if you change your thoughts and change your behavior, then you'll be able to mitigate these addictive behaviors and symptoms. But in the 1980s, cognitive behavioral therapy became the treatment of choice because insurance preferred this form of treatment. It was easy, it was quick. The idea was you got people back to work very quickly. And then in the 1990s, Alan Shore began to talk about the importance of emotional development, and he really brought to the foreground and shifted the paradigm with a psychobiological approach to psychotherapy. As early as 1977, however, the National Science Foundation was prioritizing the study of sexual addiction. And nobody had really heard about sexual addiction at that time, but except for the British who were researching it, making a case for hypersexuality or what they called excessive appetitive behavior regarding sex as a dependence, much like alcoholism or gambling. And then by 1978, James Orford compared hypersexuality to alcoholism, citing the increased tolerance and withdrawal effects, which, by the way, are still being argued today, even though we see it clinically. And using statistical analysis, noting surveys of any consuming behavior, he included TV, gambling, and drugs in that, he concluded that hypersexuality had obvious biological, psychological, and social concomitants. And yet that is still being argued today. In 1980, John Money at Johns Hopkins University was studying paraphilias and what he called distorted love maps and classified paraphilias under addictions. He theorized that love maps were formed by parental relationships and when they were distorted by a harsh discipline, abuse and shame would become paraphilias in adulthood. And I have to say that this in large part continues to bear out today. By the 1980s, Patrick Carnes took his cues from John Money and he declares non-paraphilic compulsive sexual behaviors and addiction. Carnes began extensive research into understanding sexual addiction by 1983 when he wrote his now famous book, Out of the Shadows. So in 1982, Carnes' research team suggested a history of sexual abuse was being, you know, epidemic among those that were in recovery from sex addiction. And you'll see that in males, there was 39% report and females 63% report. And these were from an inpatient setting that he was working in at that time. In 1991, this was a study of longer-term sex addiction recovery patients. These people, again, were in an inpatient study. His findings suggested a high prevalence of various forms of child abuse. And you'll see these were directly from the recovering sex addicts themselves, that predominantly 97% of people are emotionally abused. And that is what we see clinically. It's what I see in my clinic. So there was a thought, and I think it's now more a mythology, that all sex addicts have suffered from sexual abuse. But mostly it's emotional abuse, or families that are insensitive or are very disengaged. So these were some competing models at the same time. Carnes researches and establishes the criteria for sex addiction the first time. And then in 1985, Quadlin came up with the notion of sexual compulsivity. Coleman talked about compulsive sexual behavior. At that time, he was calling Carnes restrictive, moralistic, homophobic, and heterosexist. And Levine and Troyden accused Carnes of being sex negative. So this was coming from the sexological camp, where they had worked long and hard moving sex again from a mental illness more into a medical problem. And of course, this was in the late 1800s also. And they were very concerned that medicalizing any kind of sexual behavior would be pathologizing for the person and not helpful at all. And then in 2001, the construct of hypersexual disorder came on the scene by Stein, Black, Shapira, and Spitzer. But again, for those who were suffering from sex addiction, it mattered little whether one spoke of sexual addiction or sexual compulsivity, just as long as one spoke of it. And while theoreticians argued, the 12-step fellowships burgeoned and continue to burgeon to this day. In 2003, Philip Flores wrote a beautiful book called Addiction as Attachment Disorder. And then in 2009, I wrote a paper called Sex Addiction, looking at sex addiction rather as affect dysregulation. That wasn't the title of the paper, but it was the first time I started to construct this idea in this way. And so my thinking is that sex addiction is a regulatory disorder, most likely born out of chronic and unrepaired childhood attunement in the mother-infant dyad, which leads to disruptions in the autonomic nervous system and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Now, just to be clear, not all addicts or sex addicts have these systems set up when they're infants, but many, many do. Many have problems from early on because of the environment that they are born into and the mother's incapacity to properly regulate the child, which sets the child up for long-term problems that ultimately manifest in attachment and over time characterological disorders. These disruptions and any exposure to developmental or later unresolved trauma can also lead to addiction. This is the work of Teicher and DeBellis, who study abuse and neglect and trauma in childhood. So Shore's looking at the infant and these other researchers and scholars looking at childhood trauma. And finally, Bruce Perry in 1995 said that may be characterological in nature in adulthood when states become traits, leading to an intimacy disorder in adulthood. So these childhood states, highly dysregulated states, when not repaired, when not regulated, become states over time. And when something is an internal state, people will look for things outside of themselves to regulate it, whether it's food, alcohol, drugs, gambling, or sex. So one of my conclusions is that sex addicts use sex as an auto-regulatory process due to their chronic state of affect dysregulation. And masturbation, chronic masturbation, is definitely an autoregulatory process. Sex addiction represents a pathological yet powerful form of dopamine-related learning and memory. So anytime we focus on something and learn something new and we repeat it over and over and over again, we are forming neuronal networks that, when fired together, wire together. And sex addiction manifests as an intimacy disorder in adulthood in the form of chronic and compulsive sexual behaviors, such as masturbation, internet pornography usage, anonymous sex, multiple affairs, strip clubs, sexual massage, escorts, exhibitionism, voyeurism, webcams, chat rooms, sex clubs, and the vast array of ways to be sexual in our culture today. So just for the record, I want to be clear that sex is not the problem. Sex is never the problem. It's the chronic, compulsive, abusive sex that becomes problematic for people. So when we look at this chart again, we'll see that behaviorists continue to resist the paradigm shift and consider problematic consumptive behaviors, whether alcohol, sex, food, or drugs, as separate disorders and call any generalization speculative, not scientific. They seem to dismiss these neuroplastic effects related to learning, specifically dopamine-based learning, and they're still stuck in what Jaak Panksepp calls a passive information processing view. And so we have to have a much more complex, holistic view when looking at these behavioral disorders. In 2010, Dr. Martin Kafka from Harvard proposed hypersexual disorder for the DSM-5. And in 2011, the American Society for the Addictive Medicine declared sex as an addiction. I'm sorry, that was 2011. They issued this public policy statement saying that addiction also affects neurotransmission and interactions between cortical and hippocampal circuits and brain reward structures, such that the memory of previous exposure to rewards, such as food, sex, alcohol, and other drugs, leads to a biological and behavioral response to external cues, in turn triggering craving and or engagement in addictive behaviors. So you'll see this is a pretty comprehensive and clear definition now of behavioral addiction. And you can find that policy online. They defined it as a disruption of healthy social supports and problems in interpersonal relationships that impacts the development of resiliencies, a distortion in meaning, purpose, and values that guide attitudes, thinking, and behavior, distortion in a person's connection with their self, with others, and with the transcendent, and the presence of co-occurring psychiatric disorders. Now, all of these in red are symptoms of, quote, this syndrome we call sex addiction. ASAM also talked about other factors that can contribute to the appearance of addiction, leading to its characteristics, calling it a biopsychosocial spiritual manifestation that includes a biological deficit in the function of reward circuits, and drugs and behavior are preferred and sought as reinforcers. Repeated engagement causes neuroadaptation in motivational circuitry, and we certainly see that in the repetitive behavior when addicts will say, you know, I didn't want to do it, or, you know, I finally found the prostitute online and I ended up having sex with a person even though I really didn't want to, because they're seeking, they're not really looking for the end result necessarily. This leads to impaired control over further engagement in addictive behaviors. Cognitive and affective distortions are present, impair perceptions, and comprise the ability to deal with feelings, resulting in significant self-deception, which we certainly see, also called compartmentalization or denial. So ASAM characterized addiction by these ABCs, the first one being the inability to abstain, the impairment in behavioral control, craving or increased hunger for drugs or rewarding experiences, diminished recognition of significant problems with one's behavior and interpersonal relationships, and a dysfunctional emotional response. So this is a very quick way of looking at whether you're working with somebody or know someone who's struggling with a behavioral addiction. So is sex addiction an arbitrary moral boundary or a brain problem? Well, at its core, addiction isn't just a social problem or a moral problem or a criminal problem. It's a brain problem whose behaviors manifest in all of these other areas. It's about underlying neurology, not outward actions. So here you'll see in this seeking system animated diagram just how the seeking system works in the brain. And again, Dr. Jaak Panksepp identified 7 affective systems in all mammals, and those are rage, fear, lust, care, panic, grief, and play. But he calls the granddaddy of these seeking circuitry the seeking circuit. And you'll see the seeking circuit is a key player in all addictions. It originates in the brainstem, so deep in the brainstem, and it's driven by the anticipation or the possibility of pleasure. It's not the acquisition of the reward. And Panksepp says that the seeking circuitry is very robust and enthusiastic. So we're constantly seeking salience because we're salient-seeking creatures. And you see that it runs through the ventral tegmental area where subcortical dopamine or the reward system is located. Subcortical dopamine is produced in this area, but this is where the reward system or the nucleus accumbens is. And almost everything that requires taking action involves the subcortical dopamine, including sex. So in sex addiction, the lust and or rage circuitry, the panic, grief, and fear circuitry are likely fused. And we see this with people who eroticize their rage. Robert Stoller talked about sexualized hostility. So when people cannot appropriately express their anger because they're dissociative, because they were abused as children, they will use sex as a way to express their affect because they have no other way of doing it, and it's become habituated over time. So I think it's helpful to be able to see just how the circuitry operates, and it's the seeking. And males in particular will say it's about the chase. It's not the acquisition. It's not the sex. It's the chase of the sex that has us looping and looking at pornography over and over and over again. So Mark Lewis states that neuromodulators initiate global, not local, change. And dopamine is the fuel of desire. It's the fuel of attraction, focus, approach, wanting, and doing. And as I said, it's produced in this ventral tegmental area. Serotonin regulates information flow throughout the brain. It soothes us. It modulates and inhibits neuronal firing. It's the neurohormone of well-being. It's produced in the raphe nucleus deep in the brainstem, and it serves more areas of the brain than any other neurochemical. And norepinephrine fuels perceptual alertness, arousal, and excitement, and attention to sensory detail. It's manifested, manufactured in the locus coeruleus, also located in the brainstem. And finally, acetylcholine energizes all mental operations, consciousness, and thought, located in the midbrain. So you can see that all of these neurohormones are on board, especially when we're seeking sex. So here you'll see a diagram that I think is very useful and kind of fun. This is the dopamine and glutamate feedback loops, what Lewis calls the ventral mafia of compulsion, because when they loop together, they can hijack the entire brain in such a way that this subcortical dopamine system is running the show, not our higher cortical functions. So the ventral tegmental area has 3 targets for dopamine release. The amygdala, where associative memory, imagery, and emotion come together. It sends messages of emotional potency via the neurotransmitter glutamate to the ventral striatum and the orbital frontal cortex. And hopefully you can see these little arrows that show how this system works. The orbital frontal cortex will apprise value, which then sends glutamate, back to the amygdala, where the details are connected to pleasure and relief are awakened. The ventral striatum then changes the behaviors with focus, converting value into action. So in other words, it says, wow, I like that. I've got a green light from the amygdala and from the orbital frontal cortex. So now I'm going to move into action. And any competing inputs or alternative meanings are shut out. And so what we talk about is how addicts all of a sudden start to have blinders. They see nothing else, and all they're thinking about is getting into the addictive experience, whether it's with drugs, alcohol, or sex. And this is the chemistry of learning also. If it feels good, do more. Craving occurs because the ventral mafia of compulsion dominates the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, responsible for good judgment and acting morally. So if you've got all of this dopamine bashing up against the hull of the anterior cingulate cortex, it doesn't have a prayer at remembering what the person values or what their preferred behaviors are in their life. Serotonin decreases at this time in relation to high dopamine arousal, which likely accounts for obsession. And this is what happens when we fall in love. We have high dopamine, low serotonin. So we're always thinking about, what is he doing? What's he wearing? Is he going to call me? Should I call him? Shouldn't I? That's all the neurochemistry of falling in love. And then anywhere from 30 to 60 days in recovery, we often see a serotonin deficiency in this population presenting as anxiety and depression. The patient was using dopamine, it turns out, to medicate their mood. And if you have a child who grew up in a family where there was deprivation, deprivation of touch, deprivation of mirroring, deprivation of co-regulation, you're going to get low dopamine tone. And that person, in order to pull out of that low dopamine state and even depressed state if there's low serotonin, is going to chronically seek intensity. So addicts, and sex addicts in particular, are intensity seekers. This feedback loop of value and the feedback loop of thrust or motivated action is the feedback loop that we're looking at here. So this is the dopamine and glutamate feedback loop. And there you'll see it in action. So the pleasure felt during sex, particularly orgasm, serves to reinforce future sexual behaviors. And this is from Georgiades, one of the preeminent sex researchers in the world. And so it makes sense then that this pleasure that's felt during sex is going to reinforce our desire for this over and over and over again. So sexual data streams in through the central nervous system. The orbital frontal cortex, as we saw earlier, evaluates the sights and the sounds coming in from the posterior cortex, which have already been imprinted with limbic meaning. It apprises information, then unconsciously determines whether to approach or withdraw. So if you see your lover, that's going to be an approach movement. If somebody's coming towards you, especially if you're female, and the feeling or the vibe feels sexual and feels dangerous, you're going to withdraw, you're going to run. One of the hallmarks of high sexual arousal during genital stimulation is a steady decrease of activity in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex and medial temporal cortices. So in other words, the high right functions have to go offline. And it's well documented that these areas play a critical role in moral affiliations, self-other relations, self-awareness, and related behaviors. So if while you're having sex, you're worried about morality, you're not going to have such a hot sexual experience. Conversely, if you're a sex addict and you have values and morals and you're crossing lines all the time that you never in a million years would have thought you would have crossed, it's because those areas are literally offline when you're in the sexual experience. You cannot be aroused if they're not. And so this gets people into all sorts of trouble they never anticipated getting into. So persistent novelty seeking is certainly a feature of sex addiction. It's the hunt, the chase, and the anticipation of the ideal sexual fantasy, which is never attainable, that's fueled by the rush of dopamine. This commands the prefrontal cortex to take action, The dopaminergic system drives the addict to spend hours seeking the right escort, the right pornographic image, chat room, sex club, or anonymous affair partner. And detailed memories from past experiences, what addicts call euphoric recall, are also activated during the hunt. So you'll see in this little comic from The New Yorker, he says, well, I like looking at amateur pornography because I like looking at the inside of people's apartments, which is, of course, a denial statement. So tolerance is also a feature that we see. Over time, the seeking system will fail to respond to stimuli. The prefrontal cortex gets hijacked when habituation. Stimulus response exerts dopamine over choices and behavior devolves control. This is from an older and well-known study by Everett and Robbins. A higher high is sought. This is the natural process of tolerance when I want turns into I need. And the difference between normal habituation and addiction is that behavior becomes compulsive at the expense of other positive factors despite negative consequences. And we see this all the time where people are ignoring social responsibility, family responsibilities, they've lost their hobbies, their friends, all in service of chasing this higher high. It's the compulsive nature and the extreme use of sex that leads sex addicts to desperation. So these are not people that are enjoying sex. At some point, it starts to become a negative proposition. Orgasm marks the end of the road, and shame, guilt, despair, and depression come crashing in, often set in killing the hedonic state so desperately needed. Life becomes dull and uninteresting, reality sets in, and when the addict tries to stop, dopamine synapses dry up and the underlying depression or anxiety sets in. This is the beginning of recovery. And sadly, many people come into recovery because they have been caught, humiliated publicly, or they're having suicidal ideation. So in my development of a psychobiological approach, it came because I started to look at my own family and my own life, and I recognized not that long ago that I am the child of a trauma survivor and that intergenerational trauma impacted my ability to be in an intimate relationship. It impacted my regulatory capacities, my self-esteem. I had a lot of shame about who I was as a child and difficulties with my emerging sexuality as a young woman. And in 1928, my father was born. Germany was occupied by Greece by the time he was, Greece was occupied by Germany by the time he was 12 years old. His father died when he was a child. And his father was an alcoholic. He was a doctor in the army. And prior to that, my grandmother had had twins who died of sudden infant death syndrome, making my father the last and youngest child. So I imagine that his mother, my grandmother, likely suffered from anaclitic depression, most likely postpartum depression, and grief once my grandfather died. At 10 years old, my father was in front of a firing squad, and then as a young teen, his eldest and favorite brother died in the Air Force. By the time he was 25 years old, he left the island of Crete. He joined the Merchant Marines, and he came to the United States where he met my mother, and this was an arranged marriage. My father was an untreated trauma survivor. He had little to no capacity for intimacy, and I believed he may have used sex as a way to regulate himself. I have a very personal love for this population as a result of this, and come by my work and position, I would say, from the inside out. So these are photographs that sort of, illustrate what I was just talking about. So what happened was I started to look at symptoms of intergenerational trauma and the intergenerational transmission of trauma, rather. And I looked at children born to Holocaust survivors. And of course, what I found was that intergenerational transmission was first described among children of Holocaust members. Children struggled silently with war-derived messages from their parents, and impaired object relations, low self-esteem, narcissistic vulnerability, negative identity formation, personality constriction, and affective management were some of the symptoms that researchers found. And so you'll see that on this next slide here as they all come into play. Then I looked at substance users and domestic violence, and what I found was codependence due to inordinate caretaking of parent for survival, little to no global sense of self, behavioral and emotional problems, shame, pathological dissociation, extreme anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And what I saw was that Holocaust survivors and substance users and domestic violence survivors shared very similar problems in their adulthood. So the locus of therapeutic change really is and comes from both the left and the right hemisphere. But if we look at the left hemisphere and use, we're seeing that this is where cognitive behavioral therapy, narrative therapy come into play and can be very useful, primarily utilizing the left hemispheric processes of speech and language. And if we look at the right, and we are seeing Shore's theory of regulation uses the limbic system, the right amygdala primarily, and the right orbital frontal cortex, as well as all of the somatic information and data coming up from the body. So with that, Shore claimed that attachment theory was fundamentally a regulation theory. He stressed the primacy of affect, including bodily-based processes, interactive regulation, early experience-dependent brain maturation, stress and non-conscious relational interactions. This is from Shore and Shore, a beautiful paper in 2007. And stresses changes in function and structure in all stages of development, meaning well into adulthood. Regulation therapy stresses that new interpersonal relationships can move an individual to a more secure state, meaning a more regulated state with regards to attachment. And when treatment is relationship-based, an individual can develop and mature properly. Sex addiction is a symptom of affect dysregulation and thus a symptom of developmental immaturity. Shame is the engine that drives addiction. Now, Diana Fosher calls shame a barrier affect, and shame motivates people into sex addiction treatment. It's both the cause and effect. It's the underlying mechanism that drives the addiction. It's what has people feeling like they can't take it anymore and they need help. Sex addicts are typically shameless, a phrase that comes from Pia Melody, due to their high level of compartmentalization, a feature of dissociation, into what Philip Bromberg calls not-me states due to living in a context where self-continuity was threatened, which is a beautiful statement. But when these self-continuity is threatened, self-states are sequestered and people are dissociated. And with that comes tremendous amount of shame and the acting out ensues from there. People expect or experience themselves as having something wrong with their very self. We hear statements such as, I am broken, damaged, I am failure, weak, dumb, stupid, an idiot, useless, and so forth. So when we look at this trajectory of sex addiction by way of impaired early childhood attunement, attachment, and the effects that trauma later in life also impose on the developing central and autonomic nervous systems, we see that pathological dissociation accompanies all of this, and that we get people who are shame-based at their core, and often their sex, their very sexuality, feels shameful, and yet they use sex as a weapon or they use sex to mitigate their dysregulation over and over again. So with that, the question arises of, can we achieve erotic intelligence? Meaning, can we use sex with the skilled use of reason or become sexually whole? Or can we, as the saying from Sex Addicts Anonymous goes, raise our eyes from shame to grace? I believe that sexuality is at the core of our personhood, and when our sexuality is tampered with in any way as a child or a young person, it creates a shame-based sexuality and a shame-based sense of self. I think shame is at the core of most sexual dysfunction, and sexual shame is at the core of sexual addiction, as I stated. Eliminating sexual shame and identifying a preferred sexual life is key to healthy sexuality. So as such, when I wrote Erotic Intelligence in 2010, I came up with four cornerstones of intimacy. These are very simple. The first one is self-knowledge. The second one is comfort and connection. The third one is responsibility with discernment. And the fourth one, empathy with emotion. So self-knowledge means that you know who you are and you're comfortable with it. You take a stand for what's true for you, even when it's uncomfortable, in order to create change. And you know yourself, what you like sexually, what you dislike, when you become scared, when you take risks, where your growth edges are. So really taking time, and we don't have time in this talk, for me to talk about what an integrative sexuality model looks like that helps people get to the question, or answer the question of, this is who I am sexually, this is what I like without shame, is an exciting proposition for people when they're coming out of this process. The second cornerstone, comfort and connection, promotes interactive regulation, which assists with self-regulation. It allows for deeper relationships. It assists with the capacity to comfort your anxieties and connect without reacting to your partner's feelings. Connection creates novelty in the brain, and a sustained connection leads to a stable relationship. So this is the cornerstone or time developmentally in recovery where the person starts to use their partner for secure functioning. They start to reach for other people to get their needs met, much of which is novel because they didn't get that in the families they grew up with. And this starts to create a high level of novelty. And it sustains stability in relationship. The third cornerstone, responsibility with discernment, means responsibility within intimacy requires speaking up for what you feel, what you need, and what you want, which is often new to those who've been traumatized. Telling the truth, even though it may be difficult to say and for the other person to hear, especially if we're oriented towards caretaking to the other person's feelings, which is labeled codependency in the addiction world. But codependency is really a form of trauma because it's a way of tracking external cues to make sure that I'm safe internally. So we want to turn that around so that people are really taking ownership of what's true for them. Listening to your partner's response rather than reacting because you are hurting. So really being able to listen deeply and being truthful about sexual preferences versus being mean and hurtful. And finally, self-regulating your behavior consistently to reach your goals. So this is about being an adult sexually and taking responsibility. And the fourth cornerstone is empathy with emotion. This is your ability to recognize or feel another person's thoughts and moods, to be comfortable with another person, and notice whether you can empathize with how your partner feels. Empathy can be very, very difficult for people in recovery from sex addiction because they didn't get it growing up. That system is blighted in many ways. And so learning as an adult to be empathic, to care for others, to feel cared for is incredibly novel and new and can be very frightening also. And can you understand and validate how those feelings affect the other person? Can you do this without making your feelings about you? In other words, not devolving into shame, but really be present with the other person. So in 2009, Peggy Kleinplatz did a qualitative study looking at what compromises optimal sexuality. This was the question posed. And many people were polled for this question. And these are kind of the general qualities that people talked about that emerged. Being present, focused, and embodied. Connection, alignment, merger, being in sync. Deep sexual and erotic intimacy, extraordinary communication, heightened empathy, authenticity, being genuine, uninhibited, transparency, transcendence, bliss, peace, transformation, healing, exploration, interpersonal risk-taking, fun, vulnerability, and surrender. So you can see this is a vast array of sexuality, and all of these words are reflective of a vitality state. They're not reflective of pathological dissociation, but an aliveness. So how do we get to those? Well, in a simple way of thinking about it, I think that if we start with healthy sex and define that, then we add intimate sex, erotic sex, and spiritual sex. That is the equation for erotic intelligence. So let's take a look at these components then. Healthy sex asks the question, or healthy sex adds to a person's well-being. It's free from behaviors that create destruction to your psyche, feelings, and physical body. Healthy sex can have a tone of innocence and simplicity to it that feels beneficial, healthful, and sound. It may restore your character as a result of the sexual act because it feels good in the moment and leaves you feeling good afterwards. Healthy sex is free from shame and pain, and it does not create disorder or drama. So there's something about what I'm calling healthy sex that is incredibly simple, it's wholesome, it's easy. And people who are in recovery from sex addiction have to start at the very beginning in a very simple and basic way. It's also worth noting that stress, which is a major factor in our culture today, can reduce testosterone, create irritability or anxiety, and reduce sexual desire. It can create sexual or erectile dysfunction, hormonal-related issues such as mood swings, sleep deprivation, etc., and affect the sex drive. So structuring a lifestyle around nutritious eating, movement, and sleep will help for optimal physical functioning and self-care so that sexuality can be more healthy. Where intimate sex is concerned, we're talking about most private or personal, very close or familiar, deep and thorough meaning, and what two people share who are in agreed confidence with one another. And as Tina Turner asked, what's love got to do with it? Well, love isn't what we think or feel. It's a neurobiological state. We're hardwired for love, which contains three different stages, according to Helen Fisher in her book, Why We Love. These states are love, romance, and attachment. Love is a chemically based chain of emotional reactions that causes us to feel attracted, sexy, romantic, affectionate, and desirous. And we've all had that feeling before. It's striving to move beyond the temporary attraction and lust stage towards the attachment stage, which demonstrates a commitment to an enduring relationship. Intimate sex requires a conscious connection. So you know who you are and you use good communication at this stage. This creates an interdependent, cohesive relationship as opposed to an unhealthy, dependent, or enmeshed one. You have honest, crucial conversations with each other. This requires discipline, stretching to the edge, entering a non-judgmental state, and talking consciously while managing your anxiety. Explicit talks might bring up resistance, feelings of fear. But a realistic view of intimate sex is that your sexual desire and that of your partner consistently changes over time, requiring adaptation through the lifespan. And this can bring up a lot of grief and loss for all of us to talk about our changing bodies, our changing desires, our changing needs over time. Gwen Gordon says play is love in motion, and play states are not available to us when we're dissociated. So play with each other in loving, adoring, respectful, even raunchy ways, raunchy meaning earthy, sexual, and explicit. This is a sign of exuberance in sexuality and in love. Philip Sudo says, no matter how familiar we are with each other and our surroundings, we cannot get bored if we truly pay attention. And again, that's the activation of novelty. So set the erotic stage by evoking the five senses. A slow pace during erotic sex keeps the entire body stimulated rather than going for brain stimulation, which is the dopamine surge and just getting off. And the masculine must understand how to slow to the pace of the feminine, remembering that the skin is the largest organ in the body, so touch and foreplay are essential. Where the essence of eroticism is concerned, our brains are stimulated by what we see. The more novel it is, the more interesting and arousing to the brain and body. And there's a definite connection between auditory stimulation and the experience of sexual pleasure. Studies show that the focus on sounds of your bodies during sex increase arousal and orgasm. And I just want to add that males are much more visual, much more sexually stimulated visually, while females are very stimulated by way of the auditory canal and auditory stimulation. So it matters what you whisper into her ear. Taste and smell are intertwined sensory modalities for stimulating pleasure and fragrant memories. Sex is about taking and inviting a kind of nervous excitement, which is sympathetic arousal, where there's no rush to cover it up or push it away. You accept this as part of your adult sexuality, and you recognize it as the engine that arouses you and your partner. Speak your love, your carnal desire, what you're seeing, what you'd like to see, what you'd like to do to your partner, whether it's lovely, lustful, or lascivious. And whisper specifically into the left ear to activate the right amygdala just for fun. Where sexual fantasy is concerned, pay attention to your current fantasies and discuss them with your partner and listen to his or hers without judgment. Sexual fantasies can keep desire alive, and fantasies that include you and your partner that you invent together increase your erotic styles. So on that note, I want to just go back a couple slides in my thinking and just remind you that when people are drinking or getting high or using alcohol, using sex in order to check out, they're not using these present systems for novel, for close-in intimacy, for curiosity and discovery, which is what evokes and invites the erotic. So it's actually opposite. Sex addicts are looking for love in all the wrong places. They're going for the high-intensity, high-dopamine blast, but it's devoid of intimacy, so it always falls flat afterwards. It always crashes. Whereas if you let it build in this slow, steady way, where the connection is really from the heart, the genitals get aroused by way of the heart. So the eroticism is more emergent. It's more of what explodes between two people, as opposed to the blasting hit from what can be intense pornographic images over and over again, or picking novel people over and over again. And one last thought here about fantasy also is to be willing to give up control in a state and be in a state of not knowing, and so that this erotic can emerge. And the final step here is about spiritualizing sex. You want to let the feminine energy open so that the masculine can be invited in, no matter what your gender or sexual orientation is. And the masculine directs that energy to empower the feminine to feel it, to be warmed by it, to glow in it. Spirituality becomes a byproduct of neural integration towards a relational exploration of sex. And conscious and unconscious states of desire require an elaborate weaving of neurophysiological interfaces. This requires a clarity, a real presence of awareness is the only way that I can language it easily. And some report the merging of body and spirit, masculine and feminine, humanity and nature. There are many, many ways people report their experience of spiritualizing sex. Physiological arousal states can be prolonged through breathing exercises with or without orgasm, toward altered states of consciousness, which many women report during orgasm, and attained through meditation or consensual BDSM practices. So there's no judgment here. It runs the gamut by way of practices, depending on how intentional and connected people are. The stress-reducing, trust-building neuropeptide oxytocin is thought to produce the experience of spirituality. And neurological, psychological, and neurochemical underpinnings of awareness shift during expanded orgasm in females and may be due to abruptly released neurotransmitters such as dopamine, specifically in the synaptic clefts in the sensory cortex and limbic system. If you want to know more about that, this is a fascinating paper that you can find by Sayin in 2011. heightened activity in the prefrontal cortex and deactivation in the left orbital frontal cortex during female orgasm leads to altered states of consciousness. So she's not looking for or worried about being afraid when these systems are deactivated. Males and females report perceptions of enlightenment during sex that parallel verbal reports of people who are spiritual adepts. They express a unitive experience, a sense of oneness with oneself or with the universe. So this leads us to the question of what is erotic intelligence? And this is a definition I came up with a while ago, and we can certainly talk about this as I open it up for questions here. But I think of erotic intelligence as the ability to make sexual choices that affirm life in healthy, imaginative, and exciting ways. And I think imaginative is key here. I have a friend who was divorced recently. He's in his 50s. He's from Latin America. And recently he said to me, you know, he'd been dating. He'd been out in the, you know, dating world now, and he hadn't been in 20 years. And he said to me, you know, I'm going on these dates and I'm having sex with women. And he says, people are so, there's such a lack of creativity in sex anymore. And he felt that many of the women that he was going out with were sort of giving him their porn moves or their movie moves that they'd seen, that they weren't really in their bodies. They weren't imaginative and creative and exploring. So in healthy sexual relationships, eroticism is the deliberate seeking of pleasure. So we're looking for pleasure for the sake of connection with oneself and with another, without sex or orgasm necessarily being the endpoint. One of the greatest challenges of living a recovered life is to experience this kind of sex with a partner with whom one feels safe, secure, and connected, while revealing the depths of our erotic, sexual, spiritual selves. So I think this is a great calling for all of us, whether we're in recovery from sex addiction or not, to look at our sexual selves over a lifetime and to challenge ourselves to keep exploring the landscape of our sexuality, to find out who we are as time goes on, so that we're multidimensional creatures, not just one-dimensional. So with that, I'll end my talk here. And I look forward to hearing from Christy and questions from our callers. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. We definitely have a lot of questions coming in already. And I would like to take this opportunity to invite our participants to submit any questions that you might have by entering them in the field directly under the video. And we promise to get to as many as we can. So, Alex, I want to start by asking you about shame and the ability to open up as individuals toward our partners. Because, I mean, I've taken an informal poll and our sexual education is just all over the map. Some people have really engaged parents and caretakers and teachers, and others get their information from TV and porn. So how can we dispel the fake news around sex to really come to a clear understanding of terms and create a sense of safety as we do that?
Well, this is a huge question, Christine. I'm glad you asked it, because I think one of the biggest chores we have on the planet is, and certainly in our country, is to create sexually healthy human beings. And I believe that we do that from very early on. When we can talk about body parts as real body parts and not have fake names for them, when we can teach children about pleasure and sensuality as a natural part of their humanity and not shame them when they're touching themselves naturally, you know, at 4, 5, 6 years old. This is the discovery of the body. It's evolutionary. And that we have education in kindergarten and elementary school and middle school and high school that's age appropriate, where we are tracking the developmental trajectory of the human organism and scaffolding children as they grow on so that they feel secure in their sexuality. They have an ownership of it. It doesn't feel dirty, wrong, or something to be exploited. So it really starts with good parental care. And oddly, we are more sexually liberated in some ways than we've ever been. That's the good news about internet pornography, is that people have changed the way they have sex. They're trying sexual acts they never would have tried before. They're liking it. But it's still not talked about. It's still taboo. So being able to integrate healthy sexuality without shame, well, I guess healthy sexuality is without shame, and to be secure in what we like sexually and be able to tell our partners and be able to listen to our partners without judgment, but with curiosity, even though it's making us uncomfortable, is the beginning of an intimate conversation and a beginning of talking about, wow, you know, when you talk about that sexual act, I notice I'm getting really nervous. It's very unusual for me, but I'm curious to know more about why you like it. And if I would feel safe trying that with you. These are the conversations that adults that we should be having.
We've got a question from Lisa, who writes, "When I feel excited for something good, I get sexually excited. Why is that?" Now, this question comes in several parts, so stay with
me. Okay.
It's a bad thing because it makes me lose my concentration or stop what I'm doing. And how is that linked? And what could I do so that I can continue with what I'm doing without feeling sexually excited?
Well, I have a lot of questions for you, Lisa. First of all, I want to know how old you are, and I want to know what your sexual history is, which I'm sure we can't get into here. But what I can say is that sexuality is part of the arousal system. So when we get excited, anything that's excitatory, high sympathetic arousal, there's an exuberance to that, whether we're excited about getting on a roller coaster or exciting about going to, you know, a beach in Spain for the summer or excited about a lover, it's excitatory, it's dopaminergic in the system. All systems are, you know, coming up, they're heightened. And so noticing that sexual excitation is just part of excitatory in the body. It doesn't mean you have to sexualize it and turn it into something sexual. You can just notice that you are someone who is highly aroused and easily aroused. Lucky you. Now, if we were to take someone, and let's say this is not our caller, but someone else who'd been sexually tampered with as a child, say a 2-3-year-old, who was fondled, who was really abused sexually, that excitatory system would become adaptive. It may also start to loop as that person gets older in a way where they sexualize everything. And that is dissociative. It's also adaptive in the autonomic system. So these things have to be parsed out, I think, with a good therapist to determine what's what here. But if it's the former and not the latter, I would say you're a very lucky woman.
Well, Alex, you bring up something, a really interesting point, because I've heard you say that the groundwork or the seeds of sexual addiction can be planted as early as infancy. Now, is that related to the generational trauma that we carry? Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I want to be careful about that because it sounds like I'm saying that sex addicts, you're a sex addict when you're an infant, and that's not what I mean at all. So if we take the word sex out of it and just talk about addiction, when the mother-infant dyad are in a co-regulatory state, meaning the mother can attune to her infant in a good enough way, she's there to regulate dysregulated states. If the infant's crying, she soothes the infant. If the infant has a wet diaper, she changes it. If it's hungry, she feeds it. She's constantly reading these cues in concert, and there's a beautiful nonverbal timing that's happening between the two of them. And as such, she's building novelty into the system. She's building safety and security into that system. And that is going to grow into a safe, into a securely attached toddler over time. If, however, that mother is depressed or anxious, she doesn't respond contingently. The infant is screaming, crying, and nobody comes. At some point, that infant's going to dissociate. So the higher cortical areas of the brain uncouple from the lower cortical circuits, the autonomic nervous system decouples, and you're going to get dead states. That is the making of an addict. Whether it's sex, alcohol, or drugs remains to be seen, depending on the environment that being grows up in. So if that infant who is being neglected, really in problematic ways, grows up in an environment where the person, let's say he's in an alcoholic family, and you've got an alcoholic father who's raging, and this child learns early on that masturbation is self-soothing, it's auto-regulatory, he can't go to an adult, it's unsafe, so he starts to masturbate because it makes him feel good, and then he discovers pornography, that is a recipe for sexual addiction. Because he's using sex to regulate himself over time because it's all he knows.
And so when you mention self-soothing and regulation, are we talking about the same thing? That the regulation is taking us back to a state of calm?
Yes.
Okay.
So We generally, when we're talking and our social engagement system is available to us as we are now, we're laughing, we're smiling, we have good heart rate variability, nobody's under stress or duress at this moment. This is a regulated state. If, however, there were to be a big disturbance, there was an earthquake or something, that is going to jar the system into sympathetic hyperarousal, which is the fight or flight system. There's an indication there that we should run. We should either fight for our lives or run, but we need to get out of the disturbing situation. If we can't and we're trapped, the next mechanism that's available to us is one of a freeze state or pathological dissociation in which the system begins to collapse. So neither one of those states are regulated states. And in those states, we can't laugh, we can't play, we can't be sexual. We're not going to be able to rest or digest. We are in a hypervigilant state or a hypo-aroused collapse state, which would be a terror state, a freeze state. So this is an incredibly elegant system that's designed to protect us. But when these dysregulated states become chronic, human beings are very clever, and we will adapt to any circumstance, and we will find ways to make ourselves feel good. And, you know, for many, many people, excessive pornography use, compulsive use of it, going for sexual massage, compulsive affairs, anonymous sex, the gamut of it is available to us. And people who have these problems will use it to make themselves feel good.
Hoku writes, I'm wondering about early exposure to pornography and coupled with early experience of sexual abuse. How can we mitigate the potential for unhealthy sexuality in teenage years?
Well, that's a wicked combination, because if you have sexual abuse as a child, and exposure to pornography from childhood, and especially the digitized pornography now, especially internet pornography, we're seeing reams and reams of scientific data coming forward showing just how these neuronal networks are being created and how tenaciously brains are getting wired up to these pornographic images. These are incredibly difficult loops to get out of. So if you've got someone who's sexually abused as a child and then they're looking at pornography, that's going to deepen the dissociation in that system, I think, because it's too terrifying to go back and feel the original hurt, the original wound. So we're seeing more and more people come into treatment who've been looking at internet pornography as early as age 5. And by the time they're 20, 21, they're having erectile difficulties. They're certainly having relational difficulties where they don't know how to be sexual with a live human being. So the earlier one is exposed to internet pornography, the harder it is to get off of it. And really what's required there is just abstinence from the internet pornography.
Louise asks, if you're the partner of a recovering sex addict, how do you recover the feeling of safety to resume sexual exploration with your partner?
Well, I think the answer to that is very slowly. I wish I had a better answer, and it's so different from couple to couple. So different. I've seen people restore their marriages to something unbelievably beautiful that's better than it ever was before, certainly when they even got together, because the sex addict was in his addiction and the partner didn't know about it. And other times the breach in trust is so egregious that it can never be restored. So I don't have a quick and simple answer for that. It takes time, and it takes two people who are really willing to be vulnerable and honest with each other. And it's most difficult for the partner because it's sort of a blind trust again. You're asked to trust knowing that if you do, you could get hurt again. So it's a very big hedge. It's a very big bet. And so I would suggest that you get very honest with yourself and clear about who you are and what you want, because that's all you have to rely on. And if you take that leap and you trust again and you get hurt again, that's on you ultimately, because otherwise you position yourself as being a victim and you keep blaming the person you're staying with. And it becomes a little bit like, if you remember Charles Schulz's famous cartoon of Lucy Charlie Brown and the football, where Charlie Brown fell for the gag every time. And at some point, you know, was it really Lucy's fault? She just did what she always did. She pulled the football away. Or was it Charlie Brown's negligence by not knowing that the next time was going to be the same thing? So proceed with caution.
Jonathan writes, how does all of this fit in with a genetic predisposition to addiction?
Well, I don't know the answer to that either. I know there is there are data on genetic predispositions to alcohol. It is believed that there is an alcoholic gene. So if someone has a disposition towards, if alcoholism runs in the family, then generally people know pretty early on whether they're allergic to alcohol or not. They black out if they drink, or they have way too high of a tolerance for alcohol, so they stop, or they become alcoholic and have to go through that process. We have no genetic markers for sex addiction. Currently, Dr. Patrick Carnes is working with a research team in Canada. He won the Fulbright Scholarship this year to look at the genetics of people who are sex addicts to see if there are markers for this problem. But as of now, we don't have answers to that.
You mentioned the cycle, the way that we learn, which is, if it feels good, do more of it. And I'm wondering how that relates to interrupting the cycle of firing these neurons that have wired together. What can we do when we feel ourselves kind of being caught in the hook, not just of sexual addiction, but some wiring that has taken place and we're trying to just kind of disentangle ourselves from it?
Well, the simplest answer to that is to stop doing it. And to turn it off. And that's why the sex addiction model initially is a model of abstinence. So we ask people to put blockers on their internet, to get rid of their smartphones and use a phone that only is a telephone, and to cut off access to the behaviors that were previously problematic, not as a moral judgment, not because we're sex negative, because we're saying, let's clear the decks. Let's look at what happens to you when you don't have access to this for 30, 60, 90 days, and see what happens to your system. And one way all of us can experiment with this is just turn your smartphone off for 24 hours. And notice what you do in a public space when you don't have your phone to thumb through. We are so already geared towards the way these phones, you know, are constantly stimulating us, that that's an example of what it feels like, just a tiny example of what it feels like because of the stimulus response nature of it. So if you feel like you're doing anything, there's too much of anything, whether you're drinking too many lattes every week or you've gotten into a bad habit of telling yourself, I only eat chocolate once a week and it's every day. just see if you can stop it for a period of time and notice those cravings that naturally occur.
So, Alex, what's happening in our brains when we're abstaining? Is it that wiring area is starting to quiet, or are we building new pathways? What's happening?
It's both. We want those old neuronal pathways to begin to atrophy, especially if someone, if I use the example of internet pornography again, those are going to be pretty intense neuronal networks. So oftentimes people stop looking at porn and they'll say to me, I don't need to look at porn. I've got a whole encyclopedia, a whole library in my head because all of those images fire off so rapidly. So over time, those images start to fade. And we want to build new neuronal pathways, which is why we ask people to think about what other things bring you pleasure. And sometimes people don't have an answer to that because the kind of pleasure they're seeking, if we recall the seeking system again, is a higher high. So all of a sudden, analog sex seems a little boring, or a real person in real life that's naked is not quite as hot as the way images on the internet look, because these are supernormal images. They're beyond reality, in other words. So dialing it back into a more analog, quiet, simple way, at least temporarily, it's not a life sentence, so we can give our brains a rest. So those networks can start to atrophy, and we can start to build new preferred ones, so our attention is on the intended life we want to have.
We've got a question from an anonymous participant. She writes, I'm a 59-year-old woman who found deep love and partnership with a woman after 50 years of being straight. I love sex with my partner, but I notice much less sexual desire lately. Both of us have much less libido. We say to each other, we love to have sex when we have it, but it can be hard to get it going. What's the effect of aging on sexual desire?
Well, I think you just said it beautifully. Our hormones decrease or diminish just the way everything else does. Our hair, our skin tone, our collagen, our bones, everything starts to diminish over time. So first of all, congratulations. You're lucky to have found someone that you love so deeply and that you have a good sexual connection with. So there is a natural decrease. So it's not about the quantity of sex you're having. It's about the quality of the encounter when you have it. The other thing that's interesting is that for women, desire follows arousal. That is the sexual response cycle of females. With men, arousal, desire is just on the forefront. They can see something, it's appealing to them, and boom, they're aroused. But for women, once our bodies are aroused, once we start to lubricate, desire follows. Desire for our partner follows that arousal. So it doesn't come first necessarily. So give yourself a break with that. And also, you can always go and have a hormone panel by your gynecologist to see if your testosterone's low. You can also work out. Weight-bearing exercise builds muscle and builds testosterone. And check your hormones to see if they're balanced for both of you. And then don't sweat it. But think about things that are novel, the kind of things that make you attractive to each other. And remember that having sex is good for the health of your relationship. It's about maintaining this positive, loving, emotional connection with each other. So after you do it, you'll feel really good about it and glad that you did.
Doctress Newtopia writes, How can you know who's the right sexual partner? How does one overcome the opposite of sexual addiction when she or he doesn't want any sex at all?
Is she saying that her partner doesn't want sex at all?
She's saying, okay, how does one overcome the opposite of sexual addiction when she or he, the way I'm reading it is that the participant is the one who doesn't want the sex.
Right. So someone who is feeling asexual or doesn't want sex at all, I think it's difficult to have a relationship with someone who doesn't want to have sex with you, if that's what we're talking about. That's a one-way street. It's not a two-way street. So you can't really explore your sexuality if you have an unwilling partner or unavailable partner. The best you can do is be honest and have a conversation about what your wants and what your needs are. And then rather than cheating on that person, leaving the relationship and saying, this is a vital part of my life. I really want this. I need it. And so rather than treating you that way, lying to you or deceiving you, I'm going to have to end the relationship. And that may be painful, but staying in a sexless relationship can be equally painful.
And now, what is the difference between being asexual, because there are some people who expressly do not want sex, right, as opposed to our previous participant who wants sex, but, you know, you suggested that possibly the hormones are dipping. Would you suggest to someone who had a question like this, like not wanting sex, that they rule out being asexual?
Sure, but there are many, many reasons people don't want sex. Asexual is one of them, and sex is certainly now on such a big continuum. We're all wired so differently, and our sexuality is very fluid, and it really is a range of orientation. So, and arousal, as we heard from one of our first callers about how she just gets aroused when she gets excited. Other people don't get aroused at all over anything. So investigating asexuality is one. Sexual aversion is another. There are people that are revolted by sex and sexuality. Oftentimes these are people that were abused in some way sexually. Or those who were sexually abused can only tolerate a certain kind of touch, or they only like sex in a certain way. Because they're trying to reclaim their sexuality. There are people that have been hypersexual and then they stop being sexual and they become sexually anorexic. They stop having sex because they're afraid to have sex again because they don't want to get activated back into their compulsivity. So there are many iterations of sexual aversion or lack of sexual desire, let's call it that. And each person has to investigate what rings true for themselves. And there's certainly so many books and so much information on the internet today that if you read about these different types of sex or non-sex, I think people will find what resonates best for them. And then they can investigate it with a professional further from there.
Claire asks, please clarify or help us understand why the majority of sexual addiction manifests in men versus women.
Well, I don't know how true that is. We hear about it in men much more than in women. It manifests very differently in females than it does in men. So first of all, I think it's more socially acceptable for men to have lots and lots of sexual partners. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. But there's a point where people start to age out of that, or it changes, or they decide they want to be in some kind of relationship. It certainly doesn't have to be a marriage, but something where they have the attention or another person, the attention of another person, and they want to be with that person. So there's a maturity that comes with dialing down our sexual behavior. But some people that may have been in that same group, whether it was in college or fraternity, what have you, there's always that one person that never stops. That never stops the partying, the drinking, the drug use, or the sexual behaviors, that's the person who's in trouble. And with males, we don't see it. We just think, wow, he's a really lucky guy, or he's a playboy, or he's always been that way. Also, people can get super good at covering these behaviors up, especially if they've been covering them up since childhood. With females, there's so much shame associated, and there's so much slut shaming today with enjoying sexual pleasure. And oftentimes, what will happen is that women will be secretly seeking love, and they're using sex to get love because they don't feel lovable or desirable. And so they're not so much sexually addicted as they are sort of sexually codependent. They're using sex and they're using and churning through relationships because they're looking for someone to love them. So it's hard to tell. I mean, certainly more men come into treatment for sex addiction than females do. I would say it's about a 70-30 split of males to females. And I think we have a long way to go with assisting people of both gender, really, and sexual orientation in getting help with this problem without being ashamed of saying, hey, I have this problem.
I heard you say in a talk once that if we demand to be loved exactly as we are, without giving up our entrenched patterns, then we're giving up on ourselves and on our own growth, because relationships are dynamic and we're constantly changing. I wonder if you could say more about what you called a tyranny of or emotional terrorism or tyranny on our partners that results from that sort of digging in of the heels.
Okay, well, I appreciate that question. And again, there's a fine line here. I don't want to be misunderstood with this. I think the mitigating factor has to do with integrity. If you ask me to do something and it makes me squeamish or nervous, I should be interested in the squeamishness or nervousness rather than saying no, or naming you perverted, or rolling my eyes, or thinking, wow, that's gross. Because what that does is there's a defense immediately where I'm saying, I'm not doing that. And in fact, not only am I not doing it, but I'm going to turn this back on you and shame you because you're even asking about it. That is very different than someone who says, oh, wow, that's really kind of scares me, or I can't believe you said that, or I had no idea you were into that. And it makes me really nervous because I feel ashamed at thinking about doing that with you, but I'm curious, I want to know more and I want to understand it. And if you're my partner and I trust you, and it's not going to make me feel violated or out of my integrity, then I want to be willing to try it to see if I can move my edge about my sexuality a little bit forward. And that scariness is also tied to excitement and anxiety, which is the arousal system. Again, it's not just sexual. The arousal system is getting ignited. And I might find that I'm actually very turned on by that. Or we may end up laughing together because it was so stupid and goofy, it just kind of fell flat and it didn't go anywhere, right? Like, wow, that was really bad community theater and we're so glad nobody saw that. So it could be something along those lines. But again, if it starts to move in the direction where my trauma is getting activated, or let me use a non-sexual example. If we're in relationship and let's say we're in college and we're at a diner and we're having dinner and you want to dine and ditch. And I think, wow, that's really bad. My parents didn't teach me that. I've never stolen anything. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. We've been out all night and you're like, come on, let's do it. And we run and we do it and we're giggling down the street. And we get in our car and we're like, oh my God, that was hilarious. That is one of those excitatory things, and I'm not advocating dining and ditching, but it's relatively harmless. Of course, not for the diner owner, but there's excitement and exuberance in that. If, however, we're sitting at that same diner and you say to me, hey, Alex, I've got a couple of guns in the car, and I have a plan to rob the bank down the street, and I want you to do it with me. We're now in a different arena. Now I can feel fear in my chest. I can feel terror. I can start to feel like, wow, I have no idea who you are. And this is something I am definitely not going to do. So at that point, I'm out. I say to you, look, I'm not going to do this. If you do this, I don't know you anymore. Lose my phone number. This is not okay with me. In fact, I'm really scared for you that you're going to go to prison. And I want nothing to do with this. So these are big distinctions. And when it comes to something sexual, if it's so violating to you and it's so humiliating or shaming to you, not in a good way, Because humiliation and shame dynamics can be very arousing in sex with someone you trust and love, then you've got to be able to communicate that to your partner, and the two of you have to be able to resolve it in some middle ground way.
Alex, we have time for one more question, and I would like to ask you, you know, we've talked a lot about adolescents and couples, and I'd like your input on how individuals might cultivate a healthy sexuality on their own. Those people who are out of relationship and want to stimulate that desire within themselves.
Sure. Well, I think this is a good opportunity when you're single to act as if you are in love with love itself and your own body. Become familiar with your own sexuality. What is arousing to you? What is pleasing to you? Read books on the topic. Go take workshops that are oriented towards tantric breathing or yoga. Anything that's embodied, sensual, and, you know, taking yourself on dates also to places and having experiences that evoke the five senses, so you get to know yourself and what it is that's really appealing to you. Let yourself live and laugh and notice all the things that you would want to bring into a relationship. And likewise, I would recommend that you go on lots of dates, and it doesn't mean you have sex with all those dates, but go on dates because we experience ourselves through other people. Some people bring out the best in us and some people bring out the worst in us, and then there are a whole bunch of people in between. And that gives you an idea of what is important to you in a sexual relationship, what your values are. So a sense of humor may be one for you, or an intelligence, because intelligence is crucial, I think, in sexuality, because we're talking about the intricacies of the psyche and the body-mind. And so you want sensitivity, vulnerability as well. So you have to cultivate those things in your own self so that you attract someone who's of like mind and spirit. And it's important to experiment with your own sexuality. So whether that's through masturbation, buying and trying sex toys, looking at sexual videos that are instructional, that aren't necessarily hardcore porn, which is fine too if you like that, as long as it's not compulsive. Because remember, your own partner is not going to measure up to that. But there's lots of sexual material out there that's geared towards sexual instruction. So there are many, many things you can do to cultivate a healthy sexuality while you're single.
Alex, this was so good.
Do you want a cigarette, Christy?
Well, you don't know what I was doing off camera here. No, just kidding. Just kidding. Thank you so much for
this presentation.
This concludes the 8th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Thank you again, Alexandra Katahakis, for this outstanding presentation. Please note that the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. I'd also like to thank everyone who joined us tonight. We certainly enjoyed your participation as well. We thank you for the questions that you sent in and apologize that we couldn't get to them all. Please join us for our next live session with Alicia Goldstein, and that's going to take place tomorrow on March 24th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples. Thank you so very much for joining us. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey.